From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Texas is preparing to execute Robert Roberson, but he is innocent. There was no crime, and time is running out. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Robert Roberson is due to be executed on October 17th. The 56-year-old has been on Texas death row for over 22 years after being convicted of the shaken baby syndrome death of his 2-year-old daughter, Nikki. The problem is, shaken baby syndrome has been proven to be junk science. I sat down with Roberson this week at the Polunsky Prison Unit in Livingston, Texas. That's where death row is. And I asked him about that. How is it that you ended up here? What happened?
What I ended up here, I lost my little girl and stuff, and then they accused me of it because I couldn't explain what happened to her, you know. So they just said I was guilty of it, you know.
In that answer, you may have noticed that there is something about Roberson, and here's what's going on. He has been diagnosed with autism, and he's been tested to show that he has a very low IQ. Roberson's attorney, Gretchen Swin, describes him as being like the fictional character Forrest Gump.
He's been described by people who know him as like Forrest Gump. And by that, I mean he has a developmental disability that's lifelong, but he also has this sort of childlike innocence and authenticity and, is very intuitive and kind about people. He also is very attached to his mama and very sincere, as with, some people with autism. He takes what you tell him very literally and wants to follow the rules. Forrest Gump, you can make that connection. This was a tender, kind, loving man who also had a disability and found ways to overcome it. Robert, on the other hand, has been a victim of his disability.
Shaken baby syndrome. That's what Roberson is accused of committing on his daughter. That's how prosecutors say little Nikki died, and it was at the hands of Roberson. This was in 2002, and medical science thought at the time that shaken baby syndrome was a real thing.
Shaking a baby is usually caused by tension and frustration. However, shaking a baby, even for just a few seconds, can cause a serious and sometimes fatal form of child abuse. Babies have very weak neck muscles. Shaking your baby can cause brain injury. Remember to never, never shake your baby.
Of course, it's true. Never shake a baby. And child abuse is all too real. But shaken baby syndrome, the idea that a small child can be jostled back and forth for just a few moments, and that would be enough to kill or seriously injure that child without any other signs of physical trauma, like broken bones or injured neck muscles, that has been proven to be false. Yet there was an epidemic of shaken baby syndrome cases in the United States. It was overdiagnosed, and thousands of people, like Roberson, were convicted based solely on this shaky medical diagnosis, which is now understood to be junk science. This week, the conservative Cato Institute hosted a panel of medical and forensic science experts who reviewed the latest evidence that shows that shaken baby syndrome is, in their words, scientific sloppiness and groupthink. Here's Dr. Jeffrey A. Singer. He is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and works in the Department of Health Policy Studies. He's been in private practice as a general surgeon for more than 35 years.
The medical diagnosis of shaken baby syndrome, or abusive head trauma, arose from a hypothesis developed in the early 1970s. Over the decades, it has led to thousands of criminal court convictions and family court determinations taking children from their parents. The diagnosis has attained iconic status within the medical specialty of child abuse pediatrics. Yet for the past few decades, the scientific, medical, and legal literature has been replete with challenges to the reliability of the diagnosis. And in 2023, the New Jersey Court of Appeals let stand the lower court's decision not to hear cases brought solely based on the shaking baby diagnosis without any other evidence of trauma. The court's opinion stated, quote, "The evidence supports the finding that there's a real dispute in the larger medical and scientific community about the validity of shaking only as the SBS-AHT theory, despite its seeming acceptance in the pediatric medical community, close quote. To date, courts have subsequently exonerated and released 33 people they had convicted and incarcerated based on a diagnosis.
So if Robert Roberson didn't kill Nikki with shaken baby syndrome, then what did kill her? The two-year-old was very ill. She had a chronic medical condition. From time to time, Nikki would stop breathing, and starving the brain of oxygen does create the same injury pattern that looks like classic shaken baby syndrome. Here's Roberson's attorney, Gretchen Swin.
Nikki had chronic health issues starting about 8 days into her life. She had an infection that was alarming, wasn't clear what it was, and she continuously kept having infections that antibiotics couldn't treat. She had a history of breathing apnea, where she would just inexplicably cease breathing, collapse, and turn blue and have to be revived. And then by the time Robert comes into her life, he was given custody in November, and she passed away at the end of January. And during those couple of months when he was in charge, he continued to engage with the maternal grandparents and his own mother. They were all sharing responsibility for Nikki. And the last week of Nikki's life, she'd been very ill, and Robert and his mother took her to the local ER. She had had diarrhea for a week, flu-like symptoms, and they gave her a suppository for Phenergan, which is a medication no longer recommended for children that age and in that condition. But they took her home, and then her fever shot up, so Robert took her to the pediatrician the next day. Her fever was measured at 104.5, which is quite high. But instead of sending her to the hospital, she was sent home with another prescription for Phenergan, this time in cough syrup form, along with codeine. And I think that would be a shock to many people, because codeine is a narcotic and is not recommended for anyone under the age of 18. So you combine a narcotic that suppresses the nervous system with Phenergan, which also suppresses the nervous system. You have a deadly situation. Meanwhile, what was really going on with this child? It turns out she had undiagnosed pneumonia that had likely been progressing for days, even weeks, before then the morning when she, you know, Robert wakes up to find her unconscious and turning blue and rushes her to the emergency room, where the same doctor is the one that had sent her home 2 days before with the Phenergan. And they're worried, did we miss something? But they take a CAT scan. First, they notice that they hadn't intubated her properly. So another long stretch where she's not been getting any oxygen. They revive her heart, but the brain had already shut down. But what they observed in the CAT scan of her head were conditions that at that point were associated with shaken baby syndrome. And it is when she's transferred to the hospital in Dallas, a pediatrician there, who's the in-house expert in child abuse, looks at the CAT scans and says, oh yes, this is classic case of shaken baby syndrome, fills out a report that is faxed to the police, and they arrest Robert even before an autopsy was performed. And meanwhile, you know, everybody at the hospital had been interviewing him. What happened? Explain this, you know, tell us what happened to this child. And all he could tell them was this story about waking up in the night and after he heard a strange cry and finding Nikki on the floor at the foot of the bed. And then he couldn't see anything wrong with her, but he kept her up for a while. They talked, then they both fell back asleep, and he wakes up a few hours later and she's unconscious. And he keeps telling the same story. He talks about how she'd been sick, and they're like, no, none of that matters. And we have to understand that back in the day, which was, this was 2002, this was sort of the heyday of shaken baby prosecutions. The idea was you didn't even have to look at anything else. If you saw this trio of internal head conditions, you could presume inflicted abuse. But we now know that that is a completely false premise. Nobody would say that anymore. That this same triad of internal conditions is associated with accidental falls with head impact, as well as with a host of naturally occurring diseases, including pneumonia. Because the understanding today is that when you have oxygen deprivation, that can cause the tiny blood vessels outside of the brain to start to leak. And then if the brain is further deprived of oxygen, it will start to swell. And that will put pressure on the eyes and cause bleeding into the eyes. So this cascade of symptoms, it all goes back to breathing issues. What is causing the child to struggle to breathe? And what we have uncovered is overwhelming evidence, looking at her diseased lung tissue, that she had this very severe pneumonia. In fact, two kinds of pneumonia. Pneumonia, as we all know, causes breathing difficulties and can indeed kill people, particularly children. But with all that evidence, there's still no court reconsidering whether there should be a new trial.
If you have a shaken baby and you shake him hard enough to rattle the brain to the in a fatal way, it would break the neck.
Well, I'm going to jump in here and say there is not a single study yet that has shown that anybody, and they did an experiment with these big football players and biomechanically accurate dummies, no one can generate enough force shaking a toddler, which Nikki was, let alone even an infant, to cause a brain injury. It has never been documented. But your instinct is right. What has been demonstrated is the first place injury would be sustained, you know, as with whiplash in a car accident, is in the neck. That is where injury would occur. And Nikki had no injury to the neck. And this is the whole problem with the shaken baby hypothesis, is that it's completely, it's off in two different directions. First, shaking doesn't cause this particular kind of internal head condition, never been proven. And shaking would cause injury to the neck, yet in most of these shaken baby cases, the child had no neck injuries. That's certainly true with Nikki.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. We're hearing about the case of Robert Roberson. Texas plans to put Roberson to death on October 17th, unless he is granted clemency. Last week, a bipartisan majority of legislators from the Texas House asked the State Board of Pardons and Paroles to recommend clemency. The final decision will rest with Governor Greg Abbott. Here's how Roberson describes what happened when Nikki died and he was arrested.
Like I said, I didn't know that she had been sick from 8 days over. And because her mom was, they said she was an ex-prostitute or something, and they took her from her. And I didn't know she was sick from all that time, you know?
Yeah. So she was feeling badly. She was feeling sick.
Yes, sir.
And you tried to get medical care for her. You tried
yes,
to get a doctor. What did they tell you was wrong with her?
Okay. Right before this happened, we carried her to the doctor and stuff. We carried her to the hospital before and stuff. And the doctor subscribed a code, and some other stuff with codeine and stuff in it that's black label outlawed to giving kids that young, you know. But if you check all the medical records, you can see that she's sick from that time, you know. And when she turned blue and quit breathing, you know, there's some kind of problems, you know. And hold their breath or something like get there, you know. And you know, she didn't destroy my life, but losing her, and then getting falsely convicted of it, you know, that messed my life up. I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy, you know, if I had any. I'm not sure if I have any now or not, you know. I try to be at peace with everybody, you know. But she's a sick little girl, you know.
The hospital staff immediately suspected Robertson of fatal child abuse, and one of the reasons that they were pointing their finger at Robertson was because of his behavior. He wasn't acting like a distraught father in the grip of grief. He didn't have a neurotypical response because he is not neurotypical. He is on the autism spectrum. A neurotypical response is a way of thinking, feeling, and behaving that is considered normal by society. But Robertson reacted by emotionally shutting down. So it didn't take long before he was arrested.
Because of the way they said I acted distraught, they didn't know at the time I had autism spectrum, whatever you want to call it. I didn't know nothing about autism before I got in here, got diagnosed.
Yeah, so they were saying that you weren't acting the way they want, they expect people to act.
Yeah, the way I acted, because I couldn't explain how did she get in that position. I told him I found out the end of the bed, and that's the God's truth, you know.
When did you realize, or how did that go down, that they were going to be looking at you, blaming you? That
when I first came there, because they called in the police department and stuff, and they suspected me, and just because I was acting, they thought I was acting strange or unusual, you know.
Then when did you get arrested? How did they say, okay, we're going to arrest you?
Okay, what happened was that night, I think it was that night, later on, flew her to Children's Hospital in Dallas up there. I forgot the name of it right now. But then the detective said, you can't go there. You're not allowed to go. So they barred me from going to be up there with my little girl.
Were you allowed to go to your daughter's funeral and
That either. And I tell you what happened was, sometime during the process, they carried me to court, and then they took my parental rights and stuff. So they took my parental rights, said I didn't have no rights to go to the funeral. Before that, I didn't have no rights to go to the hospital to be with my little girl in Dallas.
How did that make you feel, not being able to go to the funeral? They deprived you of something that...
Of my rights, yes, sir.
But just as an ability to go through that process, that's just seems unnecessary, yes, and harsh.
Yes, sir. I felt it was overly harsh. It was like numbing, because I couldn't even do that, can't even be my little girl the time that I needed to be around for sure, you know.
Then they arrested you?
Like the next day, I believe, because one of the doctors from the Dallas hospital called me, asked me, what did you do to her? I said, I didn't do to her, nothing to her. I found out the end of the bed. And I think later on that night, they arrested me, like the next day.
So they put you in handcuffs, took you down?
Carried me to jail, to the county jail.
Took you to county jail.
Yes, sir.
Did you know what was going on? Did you think that this was some sort of mistake, that they would figure it out?
I thought they was going to figure it out and do what's right. I thought we had a fair and just criminal justice system, but I learned a lot different now since what happened, you know, all these years. And I thought everything, my mom kept telling me, if you didn't do nothing, it'd get worked out, you know. And they tried to get me plead for life sentence 3 times. I'm not going to take no life sentence, and I'm not going to plead out to nothing I didn't do.
One of the police officers who arrested Robertson was Brian Wharton. He was the lead detective for the Palestine Police Department. He is now retired and traded his badge in for a Bible. Now the Reverend Wharton, he admits they got it wrong that night, and Robertson is innocent.
So the emergency room contacted the police department about a child that had been brought into the emergency room. The child was in critical condition. I'm assuming we were told some form of abuse appears to be the issue. Another detective was dispatched to the emergency room. Sometime after he got there, he made a decision that there was more going on that he could deal with by himself. And so he asked for some help. That I went out there. The child, Nikki, was in a critical situation in the emergency room. She was being attended to by physicians and nurses. It was kind of a frantic, energetic kind of thing going on. They were doing everything they could think of at the time to revive her. And while all this is going on, they're also telling us, you know, Dad's here. Dad's the one that brought her in. He's acting a little strange. And so we did have conversations with him there in the hospital. And what I observed as being maybe what they were calling strange was a very kind of calm, flat demeanor. He wasn't as emotionally driven by, as everybody else in the emergency room is at that point. He was just kind of there. He was responsive to questions, but again, it was just very kind of flat and matter of fact. And so the kind of the conversation between the investigators was, I mean, what's going on here? He's not responding as you would think an emotional father would in that moment with your child in such critical condition. Was this him trying to cover something? You know, it was just a hint, a clue that there was something amiss here. And it just didn't sit well with us.
And now we know that Robert is not neurotypical. He's on the spectrum, autistic spectrum, and his response for high stress is to basically shut down. It was new to you at the time. I guess you didn't know this type of stuff.
It never crossed my mind in that moment that that's what we were looking at, that or anything else, early on anyway. Now, as we went on into the investigation and that continued, then I began to wonder, is there something here going on with his mental state, or you know, some sort of learning disability? Something is off here. Diagnosis of shaken baby and what we knew about that at the time, or what we thought we knew about that at the time, that kept all the focus on him, and we never kind of strayed from him as in our estimation, the reason the child was in the emergency room.
During Robertson's trial, the jury was not informed about Nikki's medical history, including her suffering from chronic illness since birth and her recent pneumonia. And the jury was not informed that Robertson has autism and his odd behavior that they could see in the courtroom could be interpreted as evidence of guilt. But the jury heard from the Dallas County Medical Examiner that Nikki's injuries were consistent with shaken baby syndrome, and the jury heard testimony from a nurse who suggested that Nikki had been sexually abused. This nurse was not trained in dealing with sex abuse in children, and there was no evidence of such abuse. But this accusation provided to the jury was allowed to stand unchallenged. The jury found Robertson guilty. They decided that he would forever be dangerous, and they sentenced him to death.
And one of the jury members, she had wrote a deal later saying that they didn't let all them weigh all the evidence on it, you know, because the head jury member, what do you call him? The foreman of jury, and the rest of them told her, you know he's guilty.
Then they convict you, they sentence you to death.
Yes, sir.
And you end up here.
Yes, sir.
What's life been like for you on death row?
Well, some days is, you know, I try to make the best every day, try to make the best, but some days is good, some days is not good, you know, some day, but I got to deal with it.
Robertson knows that he is just days away from being killed. He is very aware that his end could be near. He is wrestling with hope and acceptance.
I'm thinking now, I still got hope, still hanging on to hope, you know. And if something don't work out, I'm at peace whenever I do. Whether it's in here, out in the world population, we all gonna die one day, you know, in life. But thing is, I'm as long as I'm breathing, I'm gonna keep fighting, keep trying to make this right, but also trying to make it right for other people too, you know, because my case could help other people, you know. And that, I think that's why CCA and those courts don't want to take a look at it. They just ignore it.
The appeal process has refused to look at new evidence or grant Robertson a new trial, despite the fact that shaken baby syndrome is now considered junk science. And there is a 2013 law in Texas that allows for a new trial in cases based on flawed scientific evidence known as junk science. The state's highest criminal court has rejected most of those junk science challenges, including Roberson's. Attorney Gretchen Swin.
Twice we have tried to use that law to get Robert a new trial. And twice we've been turned away. The first time was after years of fighting to get evidence, putting on the evidence, an array of expert opinions, but none of that ended up being in the court's final decision. It wasn't even described when she recommended denying relief. And that's what went up to the Court of Criminal Appeals, and they adopted her findings and slammed the door.
The Reverend Brian Wharton, who arrested Roberson over 20 years ago, has recently met with him on death row.
How was that experience for you?
To meet someone that you're in partially responsible for his incarceration, which very clearly now is a very wrong thing. It was difficult. But Robert made it easy. Robert was very gracious. He was very kind. He was very forgiving. And we had a nice conversation. I'm stunned that we are at this point. I really am. That we are now dependent upon a clemency hearing to get justice for Robert. There is such clarity in the evidence that his attorney has tried to present to the court. It truly is stunning to me that we have come this far with Robert, that he has some form of relief hasn't already come. Here's another moment in Texas, another moment for the death penalty, where we need to be taking long, hard looks at what we think is justice.
Roberson isn't giving up hope. There are too many people fighting for him right now. But it really comes down to just one man who will decide Roberson's fate, Governor Greg Abbott. He can signal to the courts and to the Board of Pardons and Paroles that they should stop the execution and even exonerate Roberson. Abbott has the power of life and death over Roberson. If they do end up, if you end up on the gurney and you end up being executed, I'm sorry to talk about it this way, I mean, will you be able to forgive someone like Governor Greg Abbott? I mean, he could have stopped you. Would you be able to, while you're lying there, would you be able to forgive Abbott?
Well, thing is, you know, sometimes, you know, like I said, it's harder to forgive some people sometimes and stuff. I would like to feel that I would, but I wouldn't know until time comes, you know what I'm saying? Because we don't know exactly everything's going to happen in the future, you know. I would like to believe that I would, you know. And I'm not going to say it's going to be easy, you know. I'm not going to say it's going to be easy. And I would like to believe I would, you know.
Robert Roberson is scheduled to die on October 17th. He is innocent. There was no crime. And if he is executed, then the Texas courts and the leadership in the state have failed, and they have blood on their hands. And it will be clear, without a doubt, that the Texas death penalty is broken, and it is beyond repair. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs on our website, tpr.org, and you can find us wherever you get cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.